Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org. Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, where visitors can experience campus and learn about Luther's 60-plus academic programs, like engineering science, nursing, and music education. luther.edu/visit.
As college and high school commencement commences soon, we will discuss this hour the sharp rise in student loan debt and take a look at how families can pay for a college education during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will also answer whatever personal finance questions you have for him today at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And maybe you have some practical financial advice for new graduates, too. How might you recommend students save for higher education or pay off student loan debt or live frugally as they enter the real world? Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
How is life treating you these days, Kevin?
Life is treating me well, thank you very much. I'm just anxiously awaiting the end of winter.
It's almost spring. It's almost spring.
I'll take your word for it.
You know, it's finals week, actually, around much of Wisconsin, UW colleges and others. Kids are walking around glassy-eyed. But as a
that's
part
not
of,
just finals week,
that's
by the
true,
way,
that's true, that's true. As a part of our series on big debt, where we have covered mortgages and credit cards, we're going to talk about student loans this week, aren't we, Kevin?
That's correct. We're going to talk about this because it's definitely something worth mentioning. The size of student loans in America is currently $1.2 trillion. That exceeds the amount of credit cards borrowed by Americans. And as a comparison, that amount is twice what it was just 6 years ago. In the average balance of an undergrad right now who does borrow, and by the way, about 7 out of 10 graduating undergrads do have some form of debt, the average balance is about $29,000, and those who get out of grad school have an average balance of about $58,000.
Wow. What's the reason for the big increase?
Several factors, especially recently. It's some of it is from supply and demand. More students are attending in 2001. About 16 million students were attending college in 2011. That was up to 21 million, and that number has actually leveled off in the last couple of years. But most of them do not have cash to pay for it up front, and part of that is because tuition costs are rising. In the last 40 years, even adjusted for inflation, the median tuition cost at a school in the United States has risen 350%. So you have a rising demand for it, but you have less help and less ability to pay for that increasing cost.
Oh, wow. So how can families and students ensure that there's enough money available to cover the cost of a higher education?
It's getting much tougher, as I mentioned, about the 350% increase in the last 40 years. Well, median household income is flat over that time period. And many of these families are rightfully putting other obligations first, like they should. They're saving for retirement. They're having to cover health care costs, food, mortgage payments, etc. A lot of people are hoping and relying on grants and scholarships out there, but right now that pays less than a third of the cost of when people have to pay for college. Some people say, well, my kid will get a job, and that will help pay for education as well. Well, Michigan State University did a study recently, and they found that in 1979, a kid could work 8 hours at minimum wage to pay for one credit of college. And now in 2013, that same kid has to work 60 hours at the minimum wage to pay for one college credit. And while people are alarmed by a lot of these statistics, borrowing is not a bad thing in and of itself, especially when it comes to paying for higher education. But it should be done very responsibly, and later on in the show we're going to talk about the best way to handle student debt, use it responsibly, and not get buried by it.
Gosh, one of the benefits of me going to college in the old days. What do you think of what is all this going to mean, Kevin? What kind of ramifications might we see down the line?
I agree with you. It's great to be old when you see these kinds of numbers. We're already seeing it in the economy. We're seeing delayed household formation as people get out of school without sufficient jobs enough to pay for their debt, much less purchase homes, et cetera. Slower economic growth in the United States because their wages aren't keeping up with the cost of living and the cost of going to college. Down the road, if we run into a bigger problem where borrowers of higher education debt cannot repay it, we're going to see fewer lenders, and then the terms will be more onerous to those who do want or need to borrow. And then students, of course, will say, you know what, for all the hassle and cost of doing this, maybe we won't go to college. You'll find families just less automatically deciding to send their kid to school as they once were. And there'll be a lot more demands on institutions like there already are now to provide a more cost-conscious education. You might see less traditional classroom instruction, more online. We're probably going to see older students and more specific training rather than just a general broad-based higher education.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin about a money matter, personal finance question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for the On Your Money email bag. A listener named Kent says, "Hello, Kevin, longtime member listener, first-time questioner." And he goes on to say that his 401k plan of $215,000 will be assessed over $2,000 this year in various fees. And he doesn't think he's getting any value for that expense. He says that they have him locked up unless I die, quit, or reach retirement age. Goodness. What are my options, he goes on to say, to get out while there is still time? I would like to opt out of the plan and roll it over into a traditional IRA with my other investment accounts. So what should Kent do, Kevin?
Well, this is a subject that's getting a lot more attention recently, and especially in regards to the fees, because they're probably not something that he is actually dinged. Like, he doesn't see that $2,000 deduction come out of his account every single year. But they're internal fees that are charged by the mutual funds that are offered within the 401k. And this is not an uncommon situation. Many plans that have a roster of mutual funds often have funds that charge 1% or more in their internal expenses. And how that works is if the fund makes 5% in gross returns, the fund company takes 1% of the balance out and then gives a net return to the shareholder of 4%. So I understand why he would be concerned about that. He should start with the plan document. Some companies' 401k plans allow their employees to move the balance into another outside investment account like an IRA without separating from the service, meaning he doesn't have to necessarily quit or reach retirement age or die to move the money away. It has to be initiated by the company receiving the funds, meaning if he moves it to a Vanguard or Fidelity or Schwab or somebody, they have to set up the account there and then initiate the transfer out of the account. And as long as it moves over from one plan account to another account without him taking possession of the funds, he won't pay any taxes or penalties on the transfer.
But what if that's not possible?
He should cautiously approach his employer. The employer technically has a fiduciary responsibility to the employee to try to find the best funds that meet the parameters of what they can offer for a retirement plan, but are hopefully competitive on fees. And the Department of Labor and the Securities and Exchange Commission are paying more attention to these plans that just charge high fees and when there are other lower cost options out there for it. hopefully if he voices his complaint and maybe can get a couple other employees to get together with it, the plan provider, the employer, will give some new investment options with some lower costs or write into the new plan document the option to transfer the plan balance out to another more competitive choice.
What if, Kent's employer says that, you're locked up unless you die, quit, or reach retirement age?
That's probably the more likely response. He can fight it if he wants. He may be also be able to take a hardship distribution if he does indeed have a hardship. But to pull that money out before retirement age, he's not only going to pay taxes on it, but he's also going to pay some penalties as well. Instead, the path of least resistance is to develop an overall asset allocation with all of his funds, and then look at which options within his at-work 401k provide something he needs, but that at a relatively low expense ratio for it. And then if he doesn't want to contribute any more than he has to, he might want to contribute enough to just get to the lower income tax bracket, meaning he defers enough income to get him down into the 15% federal income tax bracket. Again, that's on line 43, and it's about $74,000 for married couples, filing jointly, and half that for singles. And then he might also want to move any more contributions onto an IRA or a Roth IRA if he can qualify for those.
All right. Thanks, Kent, for being a longtime member listener as well. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go to Ann in Rhinelander first. Hi, Ann. You're on the air.
Hi, Joy. Hi, Kevin. I have a question here. I am going to plan on retiring in the fall. I will just be 60 and I can draw widow's benefits. And I also have Wisconsin retirement. I have about $112,000 in a 403B currently, and I would like to draw, once I retire, $200 a month out of whatever I put this into. So my question to you is, what would you recommend rolling that into?
By widow's benefits, Ann, you mean the Social Security widows and survivors payment benefit?
Right. So I can keep my Social Security intact until I reach full retirement age.
Sure. Do you are you comfortable managing the money yourself, kind of picking and choosing which funds it should be invested in?
Well, you know, I did talk to an advisor. Mm-hmm. He recommends, he calls it an IRA, which is an annuity, though. Not your, it sounds kind of like a CD almost to me, only you can draw money from it, but I listen to you all the time. I'm actually on your waiting list, too, but in case I don't get there, I thought I'd better call.
Sure, just call each week with your questions.
annuity, the word annuity scares me, because like I said, I hear from you that that's not exactly always the best thing, so I just didn't want to go do something like that.
No, and I'm glad you hesitated at that. Annuities themselves aren't inherently evil, nor are the people who sell them. Usually, but they're not nearly as good as what is usually promised up front. And there are several things, you know, there's probably, hopefully, did this advisor give you, say, a 150-page legal document that was the prospectus of that annuity?
No, I didn't get that far yet. No,
okay,
I
good. Just, good for you. And the problem being is that, of course, they also pay very high commission, which sometimes gives the salesperson a wrong incentive to push these when there are other things out there that might be better for you. Again, they're not terrible, but I'd prefer you look at something else instead. I guess what I would look at as an offhand advice is try to keep some of that money safe. For instance, CDs, you're not going to make very much on it, but you're not going to lose anything on it either. And then you might want to look at a place like I said, Vanguard or Fidelity or Schwab if you want to do this on your own with a little bit of help and a lower cost. Many of those companies offer some assistance. It's not as much as you might get from an individual financial advisor, but you probably won't pay as much either. And for instance, Vanguard has something called the Retirement Income Fund, where they purport to set up a portfolio of mutual funds that give you something that's geared towards giving you a higher rate of income. If you can live, though, on $200 a month, and you said this was $100,000, Ann?
$112,000, yes.
Okay, $112,000.
And I'm debt-free. And I have probably about 24,000 in liquid assets right now, too.
Okay, very good. What if you can live on that, though, the nice thing about living on about 2% of your portfolio is you really don't have to take a lot of risks to achieve your income. And sometimes, and especially when you're making the transition from working and saving to retiring and spending, even though you have that welcome income coming in from the state pension and from Social Security, it's nicer to not put your money in things that that can drop 50%, which most stock funds and even some bond funds can drop that much in a bad year. You might be better off putting some of that money in CDs and then using something that might have a little bit more risk to it and a little bit more reward. But again, I wouldn't take too much risk because you probably don't need that much reward, especially at this point in your life and this point
right,
in the world.
Right, and I'm not the risk taker anyway. So, I could leave it with the company that it's currently at, you know, through my employer, mm-hmm. but just roll it in, you know, to something else. I mean, is that recommended, or would I be?
That's hard to say, and especially if you can get some advice from the people sponsoring the plan at the employer, that might be something to consider as well.
Thanks very much, and good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I got bills, 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 bills. Bill for my car. I got bills for my clothes. If I don't pay soon, I'm gone. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and we will talk about tackling student loan debt coming up in our Smart Assets segment of the show in just a few minutes, but time now for your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our next caller is Ronnie in Bloomer. Hello, Ronnie.
Good morning. My question is this. We have some property that we are to close on the sale. We're selling it. And from the sale, we will have a cash value of around $175,000. And we own a permanent home now. What we're trying to figure out is, what do we do with this money? Can we have some debt that we'd like to pay down with it. We have some improvements that we'd like to do to our current home. But we just don't know what the tax if there's any tax issues for taxation, if we take and put some in savings. We've planned very well for retirement, so I don't think it, you know, we're not sure what to do.
Hmm. Well, as always, when you don't know what to do, just call into a random radio show and ask some questions for us.
Well, we actually made an appointment to come into your office and see someone, too, so.
Okay. I like what you're doing with the money. Oh, do you know what the cost basis is of the property that you're selling, just out of curiosity?
What do you mean cost basis?
Do you know what you paid for it?
Nothing. It was inherited.
It was inherited. Okay. There will be probably a cost basis for it. Was it inherited upon the previous owner's death?
No. It's kind of been gifted over time.
Mm.
We originally had a home on the property, and we lotted this land off of the home when we sold it.
Mm.
And so we've had it now for 15 or 16 years.
Okay, good. Do you have a CPA or a tax person who can help you?
We don't.
Okay, that's the first thing I would actually spend a little bit of that money on, is finding a CPA. And we'll put a link up to the website where you can search for one at onyourmoney.com later on. But the reason I would do that is because, first of all, you have to calculate your cost basis and then calculate your gain so that you can know how much you owe in capital gains tax. And the good news is the long-term capital gains tax rate, which should apply in this situation, is relatively low right now. The bad news is you may end up owing $10,000 to $20,000 or more in capital gains taxes. Now, technically, you won't owe that until April 15th of next year, but you might be required to file some quarterly estimates along the way. So that's the first thing I would invest your time and money in doing, is getting some tax help with that. The second thing I would do is definitely looking at the improvements for the home. I think that's a great idea and a good investment at this time. It's a home you're comfortable with, right? You're going to stay there for a while?
Correct.
Okay. I'm a big fan of that. And the third thing is if you don't know what to do with the money, I joked about it before, but doing nothing is fine. And it's usually better, especially if you don't have any other needs for it for the time being, and you don't have any other long-term pull on it in the sense of saying saving for retirement. Do you when you say we, are you talking about you and your husband, Ronnie?
I am.
Okay.
I am.
Are you? Do you work somewhere else, or do you farm, or what do you do for a living?
I'm currently not, but we both have. Up until 5 years ago, we've worked all our lives. I'm in my 50s, and he's in his late 40s.
Late 40s. Okay. And does he have a retirement plan at work?
He does.
Okay, and is he maxing out the contributions to that?
Yeah, he is. We always have.
Okay, good for you. Yeah, I'd put it in a CD, and you might want to look at a local bank or credit union. You can go online and search as well. There are a couple really nice CDs out there that that pay over 2% on a 5-year CD. GE Capital has one. Discover has one that's close, Nationwide Bank has one that's close to 2% on a 5-year, and CIT Bank, I think, still has one that's around 2% on a 5-year as well. And the nice thing about those, not only are they FDIC insured, they pay a decent rate, not historically, but for the time being, that's a good rate. And most CDs out there, you should check in advance to make sure, but most CDs have a surrender charge for pulling the money out early, but it's usually only 6 months to a year's worth of interest. So the penalty for having to pull that money out, whether you need it or you find a better investment option down the road, is relatively small. But you're perfectly fine doing nothing with it. Again, especially at this time, just kind of letting the money sit, germinate it, and ferment a little bit rather than trying to hurry up and go out and find something else to try to make more on it. But maybe you'll end up losing some of it too.
Ronnie, thanks for the call. Good luck. Justin in East Troy is with us now. Hello, Justin. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, Justin.
I have a question. And my question is, I have two 403B plans provided through two different companies. And my question would be, is would it be more beneficial to combine those two, to roll one into the other, or leave them separated?
Do you know if there are any fees involved in the account? Like, do they charge you an annual fee to keep it open, Justin?
No, they currently don't. They don't charge any fees as far as that. And the other one, I'm paying a 1% fee to have them kind of manage it.
Okay, are you satisfied with that cost for the benefit of the management?
It seems to be doing really well, and it's probably doing better than the one that I'm not paying any fees for.
Okay. And those could not be, there could be an issue of causation and correlation here. Just because you're paying someone to do that and it's doing well does not necessarily mean it's better than the one that you're not paying a fee on. In fact, it could be it's just invested more aggressively. And as many investors know, the more aggressive you've been in the last 6 months or a year or 5 years, the better you've usually done. Again, and that can come back to haunt you if you don't want to lose it. So if you're comfortable with the people who are managing it for you and you think that they have a good handle on things for you, yeah, I'm sure you could transfer one over and have them do it. On the other hand, if you say, no, it's not worth it for me to pay this person to oversee it, I would maybe transfer it into the other one. And finally, you can transfer the whole thing, the two of them. You're not working for either one of the employers currently?
My employer provides us two options, two different companies.
Okay, so these are ones you're using that you're from your current job?
Correct, yep.
Okay, then you can move one into the other for it, but again, with that 1% charge in there, you should definitely be feeling like you're getting some value, and it's not necessarily have to be in the form of higher returns. It could be in the form of lower risk. It could be other help with your other financial issues or whatever. But only do it if you feel like this is it's a cost that's worth it. Otherwise, I think you're fine just leaving it where split up.
Okay.
All right, Justin. Thanks very much for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. Time now for Smart Assets, and we have been discussing ballooning higher education loan balances. But before parents and students start panicking, Kevin, I understand you have a plan of attack. What's the game plan?
That's right. Let's start with some basics here. Maybe we should start calling this segment Smart Liabilities rather than Smart Assets
right.
or Dumb Liabilities. I'm not really sure. Treat paying for college, and especially borrowing to pay for college, like any other big expenditure. I've had a couple very nice families who have called and said, what do we do? Our son or daughter qualified to get into this really great institution, and although they're giving them some money, it's still going to be $50,000 a year out of our pockets that, quite frankly, we can't afford. And I asked them, I said, when you go to the mall with the kid or the kid goes shopping, how much do you let the kid spend on his or her own? And they'll say, oh, I don't know, maybe $25 or $50. I said, exactly. So you're letting a 17-year-old have a limited amount of autonomy over this money spent, $25 to $50. Yet you are giving her or him the decision in a $200,000 purchase, yeah, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And if there were some kind of high correlation between paying more for a higher education, that you've got a better education or you made more money or whatever, I could see it. But it's tenuous at best. And for most families, if they need to borrow to spend this money on the higher education, they shouldn't do it. Just flat out should not do it. That said, most people end up going to public institutions. They still do end up borrowing money somehow, and there is a different plan that everyone should use depending on where you are at in the whole phase of trying to save for college and pay for college.
Well, what about if the phase is very young children? What should parents do?
Save what you can, but no more than that. Most people do not show up on the first day of the kid's freshman year at college with a check for $100,000. Try to accumulate a year's cost of college, and that's usually about $20,000 or so. If you can do that, that's a good start. You should save for retirement first, because you can borrow money to go to college, but you cannot borrow money to retire. And you should pay your mortgage off as slowly as you possibly can. A lot of people say, well, I'd like to pay my mortgage off by the time my kids go to college, so then that way I can rechannel the payments. And that's a nice idea, but it means that you have a lot of money tied up in your house, and it might be hard for you to get at if there is a problem. You'd be better off building up savings in retirement and for college, and then slowly paying off the mortgage on top of that. Use a Roth IRA first as a college savings vehicle, because if you qualify, you can make a contribution to a Roth IRA each year. And then if that money is needed for retirement, it's there. But if you can afford to pull it out for college, you can pull the contributions of a Roth IRA back out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And that can include paying for college. 529s are usually the last savings option for most people, unless you've maxed everything out already, like retirement savings or Roth IRAs, or you want to have a psychological compartmentalized account for a kid. If you say, well, I have other obligations, but it's really important to me to have this amount of money in this account, 529s like Wisconsin's ZVEST plan are a good option in that case.
What if your kids are high school age?
Again, keep your mortgage open as long as you possibly can. You might even want to refinance and get a cash-out mortgage so there's cash set aside for it. And if not, at least get a home equity line of credit so you can borrow against that accumulated equity if an emergency comes up. Keep your credit in good shape, because you may need it if you have to borrow on behalf of your child. The student can do his or her part by taking AP courses in college, if possible, or trying to look around and see if there's a way to get college credit in advance while they're still in high school, so that that can eliminate the amount of time that they hopefully have to spend on campus and paying more money for room and board, which, by the way, typically makes up about half the cost of going to college. Look at early enrollment. And finally, if your kid is having a hard time coming up with money for college and either can't get a job or doesn't have a job that fits in his or her schedule, have her spend her free time at fastweb.com applying for scholarships. I know several families who they've done this with their kids, and the kids just, you know, spends a Sunday morning just kind of going through applying for it. And even if you get $2,000 in scholarships for it, if you spend, 200 hours doing that, it's still $10 an hour, which is better than most jobs pay for high school kids.
Right. So what's the game plan for students, families with students about to enter college?
They should fill out the FAFSA form. That's the Federal Financial Aid form. Very early, every single year in which the kid is going to go to college in the fall. Hopefully by January 2nd, they would get started on that. That's at fafsa.ed.gov. If they qualify for any federal loans, whether they're subsidized or unsubsidized, they should take those loans, even if they don't necessarily need them. And the reason being is that it's better to have those loans now and preserve the cash for emergencies, or if the loans aren't available down the road at as attractive terms as they are right now, or even to help pay the loans off once the kid gets out of college. A lot of people are talking about kids working that could help pick up some of the slack for it. I agree with that to some extent, but you've got to remember that if it means the kid has to then take a lower course load, less credits per semester, and then ends up staying in a longer year, that can be a $30,000 or $40,000 cost for that extra year. They're usually better off not taking the job, not working, and borrowing the money and spending the time in the classroom and the library with a higher course load so they can get out sooner and then eliminate that last year.
And what about those who will finish up, who will graduate?
Do not make the big jump from college to so-called adulthood with your credit card and your pocketbook. Try to gradually move onto independence and nicer things. If you were living in, you know, student housing and you had a few roommates, there's nothing wrong with staying in that living arrangement because it's usually a lot less cheaper to do that for a year or so. Hey, there's nothing wrong with moving back with your parents. In fact, so many people are doing it right now, it's actually kind of cool to move back with your parents, even though it can kind of be a drag for everyone involved for a while. And then make the minimum loan payments that you have to on your student loans to keep them current. And if you do find yourself short on income and you do have several federal loans outstanding there, again, go to ibrinfo.org. IBRinfo.org. That's the income-based repayment plan that allows you to reduce the amount of minimum payments you have to pay on federal higher education loans.
Two more of your calls now for Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Jody in Sun Prairie has been waiting. Hi, Jody.
Good morning. I love your advice for people preparing to send their kids to college, but what about when it's too late? And I ask that because I took out about $40,000 in student loan debt, and I just looked at my bill recently, and after almost 17 years of payments, my payoff is $40,000. Mm. And it's a federal student loan, so I cannot refinance. It's at a hellacious 7.5%. And the payments are ridiculous. And I without having $40,000 in collateral and something that I can, you know, use to refi, I have nothing. And I don't know what to do. Can you make some recommendations?
Sure, Jody. Have you been to that IBRinfo.org site?
You know, I actually called them the other day because they've got that federal student loan forgiveness thing if you work for service, which
sure.
I qualify for. Mm-hmm. And they said it's income-based, and if you make more than $60,000 a year, don't even waste your time applying.
That's
all right, between true. My husband and I, we do, so fully. We don't count.
Yep, that is income-based repayment. And do you own a home, or do you rent?
I own a home.
Okay, and what's the balance on your mortgage right now versus the value of the home?
That would be underwater, given the current real estate market.
Okay. Have you been to like a credit union to talk with them about your any options they might have for you?
You know, I haven't because I assume that without any collateral, they would laugh at me.
Well, they might do it back in the break room, but to your face, they'll be earnest and try to help you out. And in fact, this is a good example for other people listening in a similar situation, and there are a lot of other people listening who are in the similar situation. Lenders only get paid to make loans. And they have an incentive to try to help you out however they possibly can. And if they laugh at you, so what? You'll still be in the same shape as you walk out the door as you did when you walked in. And quite frankly, it's a situation probably where you need to explore every single option that you possibly have. And I would go in there and say, here's my situation. Is it possible to get any kind of consumer loan or something that's at a lower interest rate or has better terms or can help pay this off or whatever? Or can you take another look at our home and see if we actually do have some equity according to the latest valuations and see what they can do for you rather than just shutting yourself off from it completely.
Okay, I'll do that. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
good luck, Jody.
Yeah, good luck, Jody. It's got to be frustrating. Let's go to Kate in Chicago next. Hello, Kate.
Hi. I recently actually paid off my student loans.
Yay.
Woohoo!
yes, exactly, last year. And then I had a fairly large tax return that I have just sitting in a savings account, and I'm not going to need it for the next year and a half probably, and I didn't know if I should be doing something else with that money since I don't have student loans to pay off at the moment.
Great. And by large tax return, you mean, of course, large tax refund?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Are you working right now, Kate?
I work part-time. I'm actually going back to school part-time.
Ooh, okay,
I'm eventually going to need the money to put towards tuition, I think.
Great.
I almost have enough right now to pay for the 2 years of school.
Oh, wonderful. Good for you. And by the way, that is a good criteria of answering the question, should I go back to grad school? Mm-hmm. Say, do you have the money to pay for it? That's the first question. And if you do, then the more money you have, the more likely it is that you can and maybe even should go back. I would just keep that money exactly where it is. I wouldn't do a single thing with it. I would definitely not spend it. But I wouldn't risk it in the markets trying to make a greater return, because it sounds like probably within a year or two you're going to need it for grad school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. If that's the case, then you definitely want to leave it there, do nothing with it. And the fact that you've already kind of got your mind right about spending that, it's already gone, so you won't be tempted to use it on something else in the meantime. So, no, good for you, but leave that money right where it is.
Thank you, Kate, for the call. Good luck, and stay tuned. Coming up, we're going to talk about how this time of year, the end of the school year, can be a great time to find home furnishing bargains. And we'll take more of your questions for Kevin at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
My mama told me you better shop around.
The end of the traditional school year can provide some home furnishing bargains if you're in the right place at the right time. So, Kevin, have you been at the right place at the right time?
Well, I feel like I am right now. Most of us in Wisconsin, and for that matter the upper Midwest, you live within a half hour of a university. And in the next couple of weeks, many of the people at that university are going to be moving out and moving home or off to other places for the summer. And a lot of them are going to be getting rid of the furnishings they've had in their dorms or apartment. These are tables, chairs, sofas, lamps, etc. Some of them are barely worth being called garbage, but other times they were purchased new by the parents when the kid moved in at the beginning of the semester, and there are many responsible college students out there, despite the Animal House stereotype that many of us have in mind, who take very good care of their things but just don't have the time to sell it on through normal means, and they don't have the ability to store it or to move it anywhere else. And so you can look at for primary furniture and furnishings for your home, or maybe the basement or the cabin, or you might have a student going off to college in the fall who will need these things, and this is a good time to pick them up for little or nothing, as long as you go about it the right way.
So where do we start?
Well, you have to understand and get your expectations properly aligned. Some of these items are garbage. They'll be sitting on the curb for several weeks. And other people are going to be taking their furnishings along. If you do find something that you like, it might require that you move it out of the dorm or apartment building yourself. So you might have to have a strong back and a pickup truck, or you might have to buy it and put in there that you want to have it delivered. And if you want to have it delivered by the seller, you're probably going to have to end up paying for that as well. The most important thing is know the dates, the move-out dates of the schools in your area, so that you can find out when there is likely going to be items available.
Yeah, and then how do we find those items?
Find the students. Check out in the college housing, like the dorms, and better yet, go to the nicer apartment buildings in town. That's usually a better place to find the better items. And the older students typically are going to have better things for sale. You might want to post a flyer on the bulletin board with your email address or a cell phone number of saying what you're looking for, and do the little thing where, there's the tags on the bottom, like you'd pull off, and so they can contact you if they have something that they're looking to get rid of. Look at the school's websites as well. Sometimes they have huge batches of furnishings that they're looking to get rid of at a very low price, and oftentimes those are advertised at the Wisconsin Surplus website as well. Go on Craigslist, look at FreeCycle as well, and you can look at eBay too and post those things as well, because a lot of people who are looking to get rid of this stuff and either don't have the time or the energy or the equipment to move it would just as soon have somebody else take it off their hands.
Yeah, so then how do you make sure you get the best deal?
Well, with all these people moving out, it is a buyer's market, so have your cash and your truck ready and have a place to put it. And also, this works the other way. If you do have some items that you're thinking about selling, some older furniture items, think about advertising these in your college town right around the 1st of August to the middle of August, when more people are going to be moving back in and looking for very good deals on furniture that they may be willing to move out of your place. So think about using the opposite dynamic to get rid of the stuff you don't want.
I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Kevin is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. We have a line for you if you have a personal finance question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Ronald in Deansville. Hello, Ronald. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Kevin and Joy. Good
morning.
Kevin, I have some double E bonds in the paper form, and they're registered in my name or my wife's name, first or second name. Now, I'm wondering if I can give these bonds to some grandchildren that are going to for their college education without assuming a tax liability on the bond.
Yeah, you can do that. The savings bonds are very odd when used for higher education expenses. You can they can be used with a tax-free distribution as long as the bonds are owned actually by the parent for the child, not by the child. Now, if you transfer it directly to the child, the bad news is you can't get the qualified higher education exclusion for it. But the good news is the kid will generally be in a very low tax bracket anyway, so no matter what he or she uses the money for, he or she will likely not pay very much in taxes on it, if they pay any at all. What's the rough value, current value of the bonds that you're looking to give, Ronald?
Well, they would be in $1,000 face values, and they're at about a 30-year maturity.
Mm-hmm. And so how much were you thinking about giving?
Well, I have them in $1,000 forms, and I would like to give them to the grandkids.
Okay. And how many of those bonds would you give to the grandkid? How much do you have?
Well, I have 10,000.
Okay. I would look at giving maybe a few $1,000 each year, transferring that to the kids, and if it's possible, have them cash them out. And again, they'll pay very little in taxes on it. And if you can find out how to transfer the gift, go to treasurydirect.gov. And that's treasurydirect.gov. And they'll have all the instructions on how to transfer bonds from your name to another person and what any tax ramifications might be.
And thank you for the call, Ronald. What a good granddad. Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Becky. I am 31. My husband and I max out our Roth IRA every year. We also contribute to our 401k, so our companies match. I have been putting additional savings into a savings account, but since the savings account has such a low interest rate, is it better to put additional money into my 401k? Are there other investments I should consider?
Absolutely. It's almost always better to put it into a 401k, not so much because of the investments, because just about any investment you can get within a 401k, you can also get outside of the 401k. It's because of the tax deferral. For most people, when they put a dollar into a pre-tax retirement plan like a 401k or a 403b or even an IRA, they save themselves anywhere from 20 to 40 cents in taxes the following April 15th. And then any earnings on that money in the future is obviously sheltered from taxes. Of course, they will pay taxes on it when they pull it out in retirement. But the majority of retirees are in a lower tax bracket in retirement than they are while they are working. So one of the smartest investments anyone can do if they have liquid and available savings is to ramp up their contributions to those pre-tax retirement plans. Now, I'd also, though, like to make sure that someone in her situation has enough in savings before she does that, so that if something bad happens, they still have plenty of money set aside so they don't have to go back in and tap that 401k money unnecessarily. I'd like to see probably 6 to 12 months worth of living expenses set aside in some form of liquid savings, and that can be Roth IRAs as well, because as we mentioned, you can pull the contributions of Roth IRAs back out whenever you want with no taxes or penalty.
Thanks, Becky, for the email. Judy in Rice Lake is with us now. Hello, Judy.
Hi. I filed bankruptcy, and it has been discharged for about a year now. I heard Kevin say in one show that you should try to get a charge card, which I did. I was lucky to get a unsecured charge card. I also a while after that did get a department store type charge card, neither of which I owe practically nothing on either one. I've made the payments either in full or minimum payments. What my question is, I know he said that would help build my credit. Is there anything else I can do, and how long does it take to rebuild your credit once, you know, to start seeing significant difference in your credit score after you've done all of this?
Good for you, Judy, and way to get back on your feet again. What kind of bankruptcy did you file? Was it, which chapter was it?
The one that gets rid of the bills.
Okay. All right, so it's Chapter 7?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's usually, it stays on your credit report for 10 years. It sounds like forever. Sadly, it will go by much faster than we would want it to. Mm-hmm. The good news about that, though, is that, first of all, are you going to be borrowing a significant amount of money again at some point in the future that you know?
I hope not.
Okay.
I'm past retirement age, although I am working full-time, which I have to right now, but I don't anticipate, I see no need. The only thing I may have to do is I may have to get a car. Mine is still fine. It's got 150,000 miles on it, but it's running just fine. So that would be the only thing I would have to look at.
Okay. Well, then that's good to hear, because if, you know, the credit report can have effects on things like your insurance premiums and even some job applications. But generally, it only comes into play in a major way when you are trying to borrow money. So if you don't have to borrow money, the good news is that it doesn't really matter that much to you. And the second thing about it is, while you may have a bankruptcy on your credit report for 10 years, it doesn't necessarily preclude you from getting every single kind of loan out there. Bankruptcy exists for a reason. It gives people a way out of their debts without having to go to debtor's prison. And because if people had to go to debtor's prison if they couldn't pay their debts, nobody would borrow any money, and we'd be living in caves again. And so you did the right thing, and you're doing the right thing. I would keep on with those credit cards and just charge up a little bit and then pay it off every single time. Are you checking your credit score through one of the services?
I haven't. I know you said Credit Karma will give me a basic credit score.
Mm-hmm. Yep, creditkarma.com with a K.
Okay.
And they do require you to register, and you have to give your Social Security number, but it is legitimate. It's advertising-based, but I've used the service, and the ads are fairly innocuous, but that's the best way to get a free credit score. If you're willing to pay a little bit more so you can see a few less ads, you should go to myfico.com, myfico.com. That'll give you your credit score at bureau $15 to $20 per bureau, and it's not quite as intrusive. It still was a little bit of a hassle. And again, the credit score, even when you have to go, let's say your car broke down tomorrow and you needed to go out and get a loan for it, well, you can probably still find places where they'll charge you a lot of interest, but you will be able to get a loan for that vehicle, especially because it's a secured loan. There is something, there's an asset underneath it. So I would actually be talking, go to a local bank or credit union and tell them that you might be buying a car at some point in the future, which you will, and say, Judge, I just want to say, based on my situation, what should I be doing so that if I do need to take a loan out, that I can get the best terms possible?
Judy, thanks very much, and good luck to you. So, Kevin, what is the website of the week?
Well, this is actually a good website for people who are concerned about taking on student debt, or if they have it and they want to know what to do with it. ProjectStudentDebt.org is a nonprofit site. It gives lots of information not only on what you should ask before you take out student loans, but also what to do if you have student loans and you don't know how to handle the payments for it, what your options and your rights are. ProjectStudentDebt.org, and we'll have that website up at our website, OnYourMoney.com, later on today.
Sounds good. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He will be back next week with another edition of On Your Money. If you have a question you'd like to email us, perhaps it can be used in a future On Your Money email bag segment. Send that email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.